Chapter 9. And little, she became more communicative, and confessed to me that she had been looking over some old letters, which had been addressed to her, before she had seen Arthur, by a man to whom she had been engaged to be married. I asked her how the engagement came to be broken off. She replied that it had not been broken off, but that it had died out in a very mysterious way. The person to whom she was engaged, her first love, she called him, was very poor, and there was no immediate prospect of their being married. He followed my profession, and went abroad to study. They had corresponded regularly, until the time when, as she believed, he had returned to England. From that period she heard no more of him. He was of a fretful, sensitive temperament, and she feared that she might have inadvertently done or said something that offended him. However that might be, he had never written to her again, and, after waiting a year, she had married Arthur. I asked when the first estrangement had begun, and found that the time at which she ceased to hear anything of her first lover exactly corresponded with the time at which I had been called into my mysterious patient at the Two Robins Inn. A fortnight after that conversation, she died. In course of time, Arthur married again. Of late years, he has lived principally in London, and I have seen little or nothing of him. I have many years to pass over before I can approach to anything like a conclusion of this fragmentary narrative. And even when that later period is reached, the little that I have to say will not occupy your attention for more than a few minutes. Between 6 and 7 years ago, the gentleman to whom I introduced you in this room came to me, with good professional recommendations, to fill the position of my assistant. We met, not like strangers, but like friends, the only difference between us being that I was very much surprised to see him, and that he did not appear to be at all surprised to see me. If he was my son or my brother, I believe he could not be fonder of me than he is. But he has never volunteered any confidences, since he has been here, on the subject of his past life. I saw something that was familiar to me in his face when we first met, and yet it was also something that suggested the idea of change. I had a notion once, that my patient at the inn might be a natural son of Mr. Holliday's. I had another idea, that he might also have been the man who was engaged to Arthur's first wife. And I have a third idea, still clinging to me, that Mr. Lorne is the only man in England who could really enlighten me, if he chose, on both those doubtful points. His hair is not black now, and his eyes are dimmer than the piercing eyes that I remember, but, for all that, he is very like the nameless medical student of my young days, very like him. And, sometimes, when I come home late at night, and find him asleep, and wake him, he looks, in coming to, wonderfully like the stranger at Doncaster, as he raised himself in the bed on that memorable night. The doctor paused. Mr. Goodchild, who had been following every word that fell from his lips up to this time, leaned forward eagerly to ask a question. Before he could say a word, the latch of the door was raised, without any warning sound of footsteps in the passage outside. A long, white, bony hand appeared through the opening, gently pushing the door, which was prevented from working freely on its hinges by a fold in the carpet under it. That hand! Look at that hand, doctor! Apostrophe said Mr. Goodchild, touching him. At the same moment, the doctor looked at Mr. Goodchild, and whispered to him, significantly. Hush! He has come back! Apostrophe. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.